Welcome to Distant Voices, a podcast presented by Willamette Week. Join us every Wednesday to hear members of the Willamette Week newsroom talk to Oregonians about how they are overcoming the pandemic. Come back on Saturdays to listen to Dive, a podcast hosted by me, Hank Sanders, that takes a look at the Willamette Week cover story and includes interviews with the biggest names in the state. You can enjoy more episodes of these podcasts on this channel and learn more about our work at wweek.com. Enjoy this episode of Distant Voices.
Hi there, my name is Shannon, and I'm Willamette Week's Music and Visual Arts Editor, here with another episode of Distant Voices. Today I am here with Larry O'Neill, who is an associate professor at Oregon State University, as well as a state climatologist for Oregon Climate Science. Larry is the co-author of a new study about the drought and weather conditions that led to last year's mega fires. Larry, how's it going today?
Very good.
So to start off, based on what you found in the study, was what happened last September, was that a freak thing, or how much of it was a freak thing and how much of it is kind of a new normal?
Yeah, so the we took a look at the weather conditions that preceded the obviously the Labor Day fires 2020, and many of us remember how hot and dry it was right beforehand, and then also the big windstorm that seemed to kick up in the days and hours beforehand. And so we were interested in looking back through the historical data record of our observations and seeing, you know, if those conditions were unprecedented, or if, you know, there was some precedent, and you know, what, and just try to get some details about that. And what we found was that, you know, during August and September, so it's kind of our peak fire season, is that the conditions that led to the Labor Day fires weren't necessarily unprecedented in terms of either the easterly wind event that we got, so those really strong east winds that blew down the Cascades, or the dryness of the atmosphere, so the humidity that was in the atmosphere. So they were near record lows, but they weren't quite record lows. But what we found was that if you actually look at the combination of the two, so strong easterly winds and dry atmosphere, dry humidity, those combination of conditions were unprecedented. Another thing that we found was also that the conditions leading into the wildfires in the couple months prior to that, the drought conditions also seemed to play a role in a lot of the Western Oregon wildfires. So we found that most of the large wildfires that occurred in the historical data record were preceded by, you know, a 60-day time period where we were in some sort of drought. So a lot less precipitation normal and much warmer than normal.
So can we talk about those east winds for a little bit? What causes those conditions, and are they sort of an unpreventable factor here?
Yeah. So the short answer is yeah, they are an unpreventable factor for the most part. So they basically form by undulations in the jet stream that happen, and there's a specific undulation that tends to occur with all these easterly wind events. And actually, we also get easterly wind events during other seasons as well. So during winter time, you know, one example is we had a big easterly wind event that was associated with the ice storm that we had in February. And those are kind of caused by a similar, basically, condition of the jet stream, where we have very strong high pressure off the coast and low pressure inland. And, you know, that pressure gradient, essentially that distribution of high and low pressure systems, basically forces the winds to have like an easterly wind component. And one of the big things about the easterly winds component is, so it's blowing air from the continent where it's drier, you know, it kind of shuts off our supply of nice moist marine air. And that air kind of comes down the mountains, you know, from the, you know, the Cascades and from the eastern, you know, high plateau in the eastern Oregon and Idaho and things like that. And as the air sinks down, blows down the mountainside, it also compresses and warms. So it actually, you know, it kind of gives a boost to the warming potential and the ability of the atmosphere to dry out the fuels in those things, in the forests. And so right now, I'll probably preempt probably one of your next questions is, you know, if we see a climate change signal in the easterly wind events, and right now we do not see that, you know, that the easterly wind event by itself was either caused by climate change or will occur more frequently or stronger in the future. What we did see was a clear signal in of climate change in basically the moisture in the atmosphere, how much the humidity was in the atmosphere. And what we've seen is that as the climate warms, the capacity for the atmosphere to hold water increases. And so it kind of sucks out water from the landscape. And so we end up with much drier soil and also fuels. So all the you know, dead brush and things on the forest floor dries out quicker and gets much drier. So it ends up being more flammable.
Talking about how climate change does play a factor in this. So the east winds are going to happen. We can't really do anything to prevent them. But is climate change making it more likely that these drought conditions are going to line up with the east winds?
That's exactly right. So, you know, the east winds will kind of occur at the interval, you know, as kind of part of the natural system. You know, maybe there's going to be some, you know, change due to climate change. We just don't know yet. But that's exactly right, is that when they do occur, there'll be a larger fire, wildfire risk, because the landscape will be, you know, potentially drier. You know, the one thing about climate change is that the droughts will have, are projected to be more severe. And so the, and then we're going to have a longer fire season as well. So we'll just have more opportunity for these easterly wind events to contribute to explosive wildfire potential.
So speaking of drought conditions, here in Portland, we are most likely about to clock in our the driest April on record. We've already had fire conditions. The drought conditions from last year have not recovered. So from your perspective as a climatologist, how likely is it that we're gonna see another big, scary wildfire season this year?
Yeah, the you know, one of the things about last year was that it that wildfire, you know, the Labor Day fires, you know, I mean, people have been warning that we've had this danger over the last few decades, and it finally kind of came true. And obviously, we've seen it in California over the last, you know, 20 years, that their fire, you know, the explosive wildfires, you know, destructive and deadly wildfires are, you know, are increasing, and, you know, it's burning over, you know, the same place several times, kind of thing. And for this year, you know, the just based on the kind of the drought conditions and the weather conditions right now, you know, it at this precise moment, we're actually drier than we were last year. And, you know, drought conditions obviously are increasing. And at this point, compared to last year, we're, you know, we're at probably a more severe stage of drought, and we're going, you know, we're quickly going into even more severe stages of drought. So, you know, my, at least just looking at those metrics, it seems like the fire season, the fire season is going to start quite a bit earlier this year. And, you know, it's going to be difficult. You know, I mean, if we do get like a nice rainstorm in May or something, that could, you know, potentially delay, you know, the start of fire season, or maybe, you know, lessen its the risk for, you know, a few weeks or something. But for the most part, you know, we've kind of baked into our, you know, our summer conditions what kind of drought we're going to see. And so, you know, at the precise time, there's, you know, large parts of Oregon that are going to be in more severe drought than last year. And, you know, so that will play into, you know, potentially higher fire risk. But like I said, it also depends on other factors too. But at least just looking at just the weather conditions, just the hydrological conditions, I mean, things like stream flow, snow melt, and soil moisture, things like that.
Yeah. folks, this next interview is one I did for Dive back in January, but it never got aired. It's with Don Maziotti. Don serves as the president of Oregon Harbor of Hope, one of the main nonprofits in Portland currently working to reduce homelessness in our city and working on the homeless issue with private funding and public cooperation all together wrapped into one. Let's hear what Don has to say about homelessness in Portland and answer some of my questions in this excerpt of this interview. Enjoy. I wanted to start off by asking about the projects that you guys are spearheading. So I wanted to check in on what's the update on the navigation centers and the laundry mm-hmm. stations?
Well, we have, as you point out, we have a lot of things going on for five people, which is the totality of our workforce. But working with many volunteers and others, we are continuing to do our mobile assistance program, which consists of a very large shower truck, a very large laundry truck, and a food truck that's working every day. The food truck is distributing about 240 meals on the street and into camps, as opposed to a fixed location. We serve six different neighborhoods in the city and one in Troutdale at the request of the Multnomah County Sheriff. And so we're probably affecting about 2,000 people a week with those services. The demand is endless. We could continue to do it. What we have noted is about a 50% increase in the number of people we're serving, or the people that need to be served, given the effects of the pandemic, the layoffs, the jobless people. People are showing up in our lines for the trucks, for example. People are showing up who are wearing sport coats. They're folks that, were never homeless, always had a job, paid their taxes, all of that kind of thing. And now they find themselves on the street or in a cardboard box somewhere. That's really what's happening. Second thing that we are doing is we're in the process of acquiring motels all around Oregon. We're doing that in order to convert them to affordable housing. We've identified 44 motels. We have 18 under contract. We've secured a donor who has given us $1 million for earnest money on a loan basis. And we expect to begin to close on those properties at the end of this month. We are working on a plan to develop a plan for the possible use of the Expo Center as a very large shelter for homeless, as well as a parking location for RVs that are on the streets all over the city, and try to give them a place to go that's, a single location, relatively close to services at the end of a transit line. So we're working on that. We've launched a home sharing program where people are solicited to be matched up in a compatibility analysis that we have digitized. We've got about 150 participants in that so far, just launched it, and we'll go into a major marketing campaign probably in January, assuming that we can get the donations. And we're leading a number of groups and looking at issues. We have a four-point plan, which is large camps, motel conversion, home sharing, and additional shelters like the Navigation Center, which you mentioned. We don't operate the center, but we're the owner, we're the landlord for it. It's doing extremely well, except they've had to cut it in half in terms of population because of the virus, and it's highly controlled. So it's difficult to get in, it's difficult to serve, but it's very successful. So that's kind of the waterfront right now.
So I know that Navigation Center was partially or fully funded by, Tim Boyle and other private donations. A lot of other private donations go into these facilities. So talk a little bit about the role of private people and individuals and companies in Portland's fight against homelessness, and how you guys work with the city as well.
Well, good question. We rely entirely on private donations from the private sector, including foundations, to make that clear. And but for the foundation support, we probably couldn't operate much of anything. because the private donations, although very, very important during this pandemic period, have scaled back by probably 30 to 40% for all nonprofits everywhere. And many nonprofits have folded. We're in no position and not will not be folding. I'm just saying that it has created a shortage of donor activity from our standpoint, but we've gotten a lot of support from foundations, the Oregon Community Foundation, Maybelle Clark. I mean, a number of foundations are funding various of our efforts, and so that's working. We coordinate with local governments to the extent that it's necessary and helpful. I don't know what to say. We attempt to coordinate best we can. We're waiting for more leadership from every level of government, including ourselves, as having a responsibility to increase the level of service that we provide. We were just contacted by the Oregon Health Authority, actually asking us to expand our services and indicating that they would provide CARES Act funding for that work. And so that would be the first time that we engaged with, financing from the government.
I mean, I've been at meetings with Oregon Harbor of Hope, and, the mayor's office is there, some representatives from the state. So why have you chosen to go the route of really going fully to private? Was that a choice that you guys made, or is that just how things turned out?
Well, really two things from my standpoint. Number one, it's, if you're in the community and you're a private sector operative in this community, you have probably gained a lot of benefit from being here. It's your market, or it's your labor market, if not your direct sales market. And so given that, we really expect all members of the community to participate. The voters are participating by taxing themselves to support the housing bond and the service bond and other measures. And we expect the private sector to pony up and do it. And we decided to go that route because we believe that there's a important role. The second reason really is that the government can't do it. They're doing all that they can within the limitations of the political system and the financial systems and all that kind of thing, but they can't even begin to tackle the size of this problem. We've got 4,000 people on the street every night, scattered all over the area. The government cannot provide all of the services necessary. And so we're working on a model where the private sector plays a major role. And the Hope Motels conversion projects, we intend to use those projects by creating a for-profit entity, which would be controlled by Oregon Harbor of Hope, that would solicit investors into each of those projects with a return to them, so we could get that investment money put into the motel conversion business, creating affordable housing as a result. That's kind of our business model on that. And I expect the private sector will be interested if we can give them a decent return.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Distant Voices. Thank you to everyone who was a part of this episode, including the guests and Willamette Week Newsroom. Also, special thank you to AmpMusic.co and Heather Witte for the music that you heard on this podcast. For more great content, be sure to follow Dive by Willamette Week on all podcast platforms. Join us Saturdays for our Dive podcast show, and follow along with Willamette Week's content at WWeek.com and on all social platforms. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.